This is the House Water Committee meeting on Wednesday, April 27th. And to start off with, and my apologies to Senator Whitsitt, who is here to talk to us about the Klamath adjudication issue, process, and policy. And I want to hear this other bill, and it'll take me, it'll take us, 5 minutes or I don't know how long. That's not enough time? Or do you want to come back at the end of the hearing? Okay. How about, which would you like to do? Where'd Brendan run off to?
He's just right outside the door.
Mr. McCarthy, would you prefer to come back at the end of, when we finish with the informational meeting? Or would you, you know?
At your disposal anytime you want. I can watch and monitor. Or
He
has to go testify.
Well, it wouldn't do as much good because we don't have a quorum here now.
Anyway.
Can we have you watch the monitor and then pick it up at the end of the session so that we can get started here and so Senator Whitsitt can get on to the other business that I know he's got piled up on his desk too. So with that, then, we're going to open a informational meeting. And this is going to be an overview of the Klamath Basin adjudication process and policy. And we have Senator Whitsitt. Did you want to start? Okay. Emily Wolf, the Executive Director of Water for Life.
Thank you, Chair. Chair Jensen and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Emily Wolf. I'm the Executive Director of Water for Life Incorporated. Thank you for inviting us to speak to you today about Oregon's adjudication process and policies, particularly as they relate to the Klamath adjudication. It's really a privilege to be here, and we're excited to proceed. I would like to take a moment just to introduce today's panel members to you. They will state their name for the record when they come up here as well. But our endeavor today was to present a very on-the-ground look at the adjudication proceedings. And to that effect, I am pleased to be able to welcome Roger Nicholson of Fort Klamath, Ambrose McAuliffe of Fort Klamath, and Ed Bartell of Sprague River, as well as someone who really needs no introduction, Senator Doug Whitsitt from Senate District 28, which includes Klamath Lake and Crook, as well as parts of Jackson and Deschutes counties. Roger Nicholson and Ambrose McAuliffe are the two founding members of Water for Life. They started Water for Life 15 years ago and are intimately acquainted with water issues and are very, very much involved in the Klamath adjudication. Like I said, we want to give you a perspective from the little guys, and we hope that you can gain some understanding of what the adjudication means to the people on the ground. I know that even for myself as an employee of this organization, much of this information seems very remote. But these are the folks on the ground. These are the folks that are going through it, and I think that their perspectives are, in that regard, incredibly valuable. Briefly, what you will hear today is an overview of the adjudication process, as well as some specific problems and subsequent recommendations from the on-the-ground producer perspective for improving the adjudication process, and also some personal testimony on just what the process has meant to the folks on the ground. With that, I would like to just take a moment to kind of go through your supplemental packet that Water for Life provided. This is a packet of materials compiled that offer information into the adjudication itself and kind of where some of the concepts have come from. It starts out with the revised statutes, the Chapter 539, which is the adjudication statute. Your second tab are then the rules that are used to implement this statute. And third tab is a case, the U.S. versus Oregon, that the importance of which is that it allows federal reserve rights, that is water rights that the federal government wants to reserve, to be adjudicated by the state. And that is one thing that makes the Klamath adjudication much different from any adjudication that has taken place in the state before. The McCarran Amendment, then in tab 4, this waives the sovereign immunity of the United States, allowing states to adjudicate the federal government's claims. And going back to U.S. versus Oregon, I think it's important to note that this case states that the adjudication proceedings must be judicial in nature. There must be sufficient judicial material in nature for the state to be able to adjudicate them. If it were only an administrative process, this would not hold. Basically, the power is with the state to adjudicate these rights as long as there is a significant judicial process in place. Tab 5, U.S. v. Puerto Rico, this just affirms U.S. v. Oregon and the McCarran Amendment. Again, it's a very recent case, and that's important to note, in 2002. Tab 6 is an Attorney General opinion issued in 1996 that the most important component, in our view, is that the adjudication can only be complete upon a circuit court decree, and that one should not be regulated by administrative proceeding, but that the circuit court decree has the final word in the adjudication. In addition to that, tab 7 and tab 8 just provide basic background materials into what else is included in here in your packet. So, with that, I would like to welcome our panel members, and again, thank you for inviting us to provide this information for you today.
Good afternoon.
Thank you, Chair Jensen, committee members. For the record, I'm Senator Doug Whitsett, District 28, representing Klamath, Lake, Crook, and parts of Jackson and Deschutes counties. My intention this afternoon is to provide the committee with a simplified overview of the Oregon surface water adjudication process and then briefly to identify some areas within that process that I perceive as problematic. Prior to 1909, as most of you I'm sure know, water rights in Oregon were acquired by appropriation of riparian right or accrued to the United States and Indian tribes under federal law as reserved rights. The first party to divert water for beneficial use has the right to continue to divert that amount of water without interference from subsequent appropriators, so long as the water continues to be put to beneficial use. In case of shortages, the entire share of the most recent appropriator is lost before the share of the next previous appropriator is diminished. The right is appurtenant to the land on which the beneficial use is applied and is perpetual during continuous use. It is a very valuable private property right that is purchased with the land, sold with the land, mortgaged with the land, and taxed with the land. In arid eastern Oregon, the water right usually comprises more than 95% of the value of that irrigated land. Under this system, the date of appropriation and the amount of water appropriated are the critical facts in determining the relative rights of water users. In 1909, Oregon created its present statutory system for the mass adjudication of surface water rights. It was established by statute that after the 1909 date, water rights could only be acquired through a permit system. All water rights that had been vested prior to that 1909 date were placed in one of two categories. If the pre-1909 vested water right had been judicially determined, the quantity of water so adjudicated became permanently appurtenant to the land where it was beneficially used. In the pre-1909 vested water right had not been judicially determined, it was left intact as an undetermined vested right. This undetermined vested right has a certain priority date and a presumptive duty, but has not been legally quantified by the adjudication process. The statute required that every person or entity claiming an undetermined vested right must file a registration statement describing the claim and including the information necessary to judicially determine the claim vested or reserved right. The Klamath adjudication is the effort to judicially determine the undetermined vested rights within the Klamath River watershed in Oregon. The adjudication process is started by the Oregon Water Resources Department on its own initiative or upon the petition by a claimant. Notice that the Oregon Water Resources Department will initiate an adjudication and begin investigating the particular stream or basin is published in two newspapers of general circulation of the area. The Oregon Water Resources Department then investigates the stream that is being adjudicated. The examination shall include the measurement of the discharge of the stream and of the various diversions and distribution works. When the stream investigation is completed, the director again gives notice stating the testimony regarding the rights of the claimant will be taken and recorded. Claimants are required to provide the Oregon Water Resources Department with proof of their respective claims. The contest phase of adjudication begins after all testimony has been recorded. Persons involved in adjudication are allowed to present affidavits and appear before the director to contest or dispute the claims of others or to defend their claims against the contest of others. When all contests have been heard by the director, an examination of the contested claims is begun by the department. Upon completion of the contested case hearings and thorough examination of the contested claims, the director issues into the record of the department findings of fact and an order of determination determining and establishing the rights to the waters of that stream. The Oregon Water Resources Department order of determination is then filed with the clerk of the circuit court and parties to the adjudication are notified of the order. After the order of determination is filed with the circuit court, and party involved in the adjudication is allowed to file an exception with the circuit court. If an exception is filed with the circuit court, hearings are held regarding these exceptions while all parties involved are allowed to present testimony and affidavits. The circuit court then issues a decree based on the evidence affirming or modifying the Oregon Water Resources Department's order of determination. The circuit court may also remand the case to the Oregon Water Resources Department for further review. Ultimately, the decree issued by the circuit court is transmitted to the Oregon Water Resources Department and becomes the enforceable order of determination used by the state water masters. The circuit court's decree may be further appealed to the Oregon Court of Appeals within 60 days after the judgment. As complex as this procedure seems, it is in practice much more convoluted. The Klamath adjudication is further complicated and made more complex by rights held in trust by the Bureau of Reclamation. Federally reserved rights allegedly included at least U.S. Forest Service, Bureau of Land Management, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, U.S. Wildlife Refuge Service, and U.S. Park Service's reserved rights, rights purchased and owned by the federal government, tribal reserve rights, rights owned by tribal allottees, former tribal allottee rights now owned by non-tribal members, federal tribal trust requirements, as well as myriad contests regarding the pre-1909 appropriated rights. Areas of concern for me include the incomplete evaluation of Oregon Water Resources Department of the discharge of various stream segments to be adjudicated. This evaluation is required prior to beginning the adjudication process under ORS 539.120. Adjudication contests that are heard by unqualified administrative law judges ensuring subsequent circuit court resolution of significant additional expense. Inclusion of Federal Reserve rights in the adjudication when that inclusion is discretionary by Oregon Water Resources Department. By inclusion of federally reserved rights, the Oregon Water Resources Department has voluntarily opened the probability of re-adjudication of all streams and basins in Oregon at incredible expense to Oregon's landowners. The fact that only the property owner who is defending his current owned property rights is required to pay for his own legal counsel is also disturbing. The fact that the cost incurred to defend these currently owned private property rights can, and often does, exceed the value of the private property. The fact that, by contesting every affidavit and motion, parties not exposed to payment of oppressive legal cost are able to bankrupt the owners of private property that are responsible for their own legal costs in defending their own private property rights. This is truly an issue that will affect all of rural Oregon and all of Oregon irrigators. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, Chair Jensen and committee members.
Thank you, Senator. Appreciate your information that we have there. I don't think that we will, unless somebody has, you know, immediate sort of questions, I don't think we'll ask questions at this point until we kind of get a little bit further through. So could we go on then with...
I'm Roger Nicholson. I'm president of Resource Conservancy and the Fort Klamath Critical Habitat Landowners, which are two nonprofit groups representing water users in the Klamath adjudication, as well as I'm an irrigator. Family has some of the same land in its hands. It has been there for 100 years or over, well over 100 years actually. But active participant in the adjudication myself, and I have to say that at times it has not been a pleasant process. The inclusion of Federal Reserve rights within the adjudication are not mandated, never have been mandated by state law. It was a judgment decision of the Water Resource Department to include the Federal Reserve rights within the adjudication, created significant problems for private irrigators. You have... I'll just take one for example. Bureau of Indian Affairs, their claims for in-stream usage far exceed what the in-stream flows actually are. Far, far exceeded on every month, year-round. And with a $2.5 million biological study to justify that. As well as having to defend ourselves against those claims as individual users. This isn't an irrigation district we're talking about. We're talking about long-term family-held family farms and ranches. But in addition to having to defend ourselves against those claims, we've had to present our own claims simultaneously. Individual farmers and ranchers under the present system can't afford it. We've had people drop out. We've had people sell their farms and ranches out of frustration just simply because they can't afford the process. In the state of Oregon, it always seemed odd to me that we'll pay for the defense of criminal indigent defendants, but producers, we put them in an untenable situation as we've been in, and there is no help. There is no help. You pay the bill or you get out. And I might say that as far as hiring the most expensive consultants, as far as hiring the best legal firms in the nation, we're not offered that opportunity. We don't have unlimited funds as the federal government, who is not only claiming the water which we've used for well over 100 years, but they are also turning around and resisting our claims within the adjudication to be granted that water for continuance. I think that one ought to look. We have one gentleman in the room that is not scheduled to testify today. His personal bill in just defending his own claim on his family farm is over $50,000 now. Our organization, which handles the tries to handle the defense of the whole group, is well over $1 million. Fort Klamath Critical Habitat, in the last 5 years, the legal bills are $790,000. This is from just a small group of family farms and ranches. With the inclusion of these Federal Reserve rights, we've made it just an untenable situation. Yet, I do appreciate the opportunity to speak about that because I don't think many in the department or many in the bureaucracy recognize that, nor do they act like they care either. If you can't afford to play the game, get out, has sort of been the attitude. Anyway, there's several other points that I'd like to briefly discuss where the process perhaps has gone awry. One of which is that somewhere the department decided to have a preliminary analysis, and they came out with preliminary analysis of who would be granted the water rights. I don't know anywhere where that is allowed or where it was encouraged in rules, statute, or whatever. But I think it needs to be specifically addressed what happened when the preliminary analysis was issued, because everybody was forced to turn around and respond to those. Now, what sort of response was there? The Bureau of Indian Affairs found that this was such a bad deal that they were into, they so disagreed with how the department was going to handle it, potentially handle it. Mind you, it had been no firm decisions made. What did they do? They sued our private air geeters and put us back into federal court and reopened a federal court case that had started in the Adair case was culminated in 1979. But because of this preliminary analysis, and primarily because of this, we were sued. We were put back into a situation where we went into the Panner Court in Portland and had to eventually go on to the Ninth Circuit, and the Adair case was reinstated and forbid the Bureau of Indian Affairs from doing it again. But what was the net result? I can quite well tell you the net result was that my group was responsible to raise over $500,000 to defend that case as private air geeters. Now, the state of Oregon might tell you, and they adequately could tell you, they also defended that case. But we, as private individuals, were ones being sued on the ground. And that all resulted from a preliminary analysis that was not even necessary, nor do I think required by law. Just further costs that we have been forced to incur. The present process, and I'd like to address the present process within the adjudication process within the state of Oregon. You have to recognize that the code was passed in 1909, and it called for the adjudicator to be the state engineer. The state engineer at that time was a recognized expert in the water situation everywhere within the state and had a handle on all the water resources. That duty was transferred to the Water Resource Director, the now Water Resource Director, who is a political appointee, is the appointed adjudicator. And because of other duties, that was transferred to an appointment of the political appointee, an adjudicator. Now, what is the significance of this in the system? The adjudicator makes a decision whereby water can be given to one person, taken away from another. He makes that decision before it goes to circuit court. He makes that final decision. Now, the process is now exists. The claims are taken, the evidence is submitted, and contested cases happen. That's all big part of the process. The contested cases are a big part of the process. But once the contested case hearing officers make their decision, they submit that to the adjudicator. And he takes the other evidence there, and he makes a decision on distribution. Now, let's review who the adjudicator is. He is an appointment of a political appointment. We call the Oregon process an administrative process, but suddenly we are distributing water on the basis of politics. I think that it ought to be very, very clear that Oregon Code calls for that, recognizes it, and encourages that. There are those that said it's too administrative heavy. Well, it's too political heavy, too. By far too political heavy. Eventually, it does get to circuit court, and once it gets to circuit court, if any exceptions are filed, new evidence is taken, and you start the whole process over again. You have essentially two full trials before you ever even get into appeal process. It goes on, and every day the time clocks of the attorneys and the expert witnesses are running. Every day they're running. I think we ought to review also, or not review, but speak a bit of the administrative judge process that we have that we're put under. Oregon statute requires that the chief administrative judge tries to appoint judges who are familiar with the issues. We're talking about one of the most complex cases of interplay of federal and state water law that has ever been heard in the western United States. Who do we have for administrative judges? They're probably fine judges, and they're probably fair and equitable people. Do they have any natural resource experience at all? They all came from the employment division. They all came from the employment division. What does that tell us? It might not tell us anything. They may have done outside natural resource work. I don't know. But also, the Oregon Code guarantees us the right to recuse any judge one judge for no reason, any judge for reason. Upon asking for the records and the experience of these judges to see if they were naturally resource-oriented, we were denied that. We were completely denied and told these records were sealed and denied to us because of protection of union contracts and so forth. The only body that could ever look at those records were their direct superior or the police. So we have a right to recuse judges, but no ability to discover why we should recuse them. Seems a bit abstract system to me, to say the least, that we are in a system like this. But anyway, once you do make those decisions and once you get to circuit court level, you are actually on a judicial basis at that time. But you're already into a second round of original trials, so to speak. And you're already, for small irrigators like ourselves, you're already into millions and millions of costs. I can't emphasize enough, my resource conservancy had 5 board directors 2 years ago. 3 of them have already sold out and said, this isn't worth it. We're leaving the state of Oregon, not to come back. It's just not worth it. There's too big a risk if we lose to the Federal Reserve rights. The federal government will have the land. They'll have the water, I should say, and our places will be valueless, and we can't afford to fund, absolutely can't afford to fund an adequate legal defense. This is not to be somewhat cynical, this is the reward we give our producers. It's a bad, bad situation that we put those producers in. There are some other points, and I think that I would like to talk about some potential solutions once we get done talking about problems, but I'm going to let my friend, if I might, Edward Bartell, speak about some points he was talking about, going to talk about. Thank you.
Yeah, the main thing I wanted to discuss is the statutory requirement that the water resources is required to measure the discharge of the stream.
Excuse me, sir. For the record, your name?
Edward Bartell.
Thank you.
I primarily wanted to discuss the statutory requirement that the Water Resources Department is required to measure the discharge of the stream. It's very clear in statute. It says measure. And the Water Resources Department has, through administrative rule, used the word estimate instead of measure, which is a major problem in this circumstance. What the Water Resources Department has done is developed a process for developing natural stream flows and water availability for various basins to determine if there's enough water available for somebody filing for a new water right. What in essence they've done is transpose this process into the Klamath adjudication, where we have a few good long-term records, but there is claims for several federal entities in stream reaches. So you might have a stream reach from River Mile 1 to River Mile 10, River Mile 11 to River Mile 15, until you have 8 or 10 of these up the whole river system. If these claims are granted as filed, each one of these reaches has to have that amount of flow in it from top to bottom before anybody else can irrigate, or a call can be made if that amount of water is not available. The huge problem we have here is we're going into this hearing process with not the foggiest idea how much water is available in the stream. What the Water Resources has done, like I say, there's a few spots where we have good long-term records. It is pretty clear what's taking place there. But there's many stream reaches where we don't have any data that other than these estimates that the computer spits out, where they put in slope and elevation and rainfall and then correct it back to the gauge data that may be several miles away to try and develop an estimate of the amount of flow there. And for this process, it's absolutely worthless because we've found many locations where it's not correct, and it can be off by order of magnitude. Just for example, there's one in the Wood River where they have, a claim for the entire reach. At the lower end, there's a gauge there, so we know what that is. But the claim has to be met for the entire reach, so there's down at the lower end where the mouth of the system is, it's like 80 second feet. At the top, it's 5 second feet. So if that claim was to be granted for the full amount, for the full reach, there is no way in the world that the guys at the top of the stream could ever irrigate. And we're looking at that whole problem throughout this, throughout the basin. And some of them, a few of them, we've been able to go out and measure. But private producers do not have the money to go out and do the water resources job for them, to determine the flow in each one of these reaches. And it's absolutely essential to have a fair process that measurement be done. And we were fortunate that we reached a settlement with the Forest Service, and we settled several of these. And hopefully we've reached a settlement with the tribes and the federal government, and a big chunk of this adjudication will be done if we can move this settlement forward. Unfortunately, the Water Resources wants to has this sped up process to move through the adjudication, and I don't believe in delay for the sake of delay, but I think it's incredibly important here that we have enough time to get this settlement through that could save literally 20 years off of the adjudication process by just giving us a little bit of time to get the final federal approval. We've got the tribal approval. We have a signed document between the upper basin irrigators and the tribes to reach a settlement. And I'm coming back to the stream measurement with this issue, and I believe Mr. Nicholson will talk about this settlement a little bit more. But just as food for thought for this committee and this state, assume for a moment that the ALJ making the decision and ultimately the adjudicator assumes a flow of 500 second feet in a river system. They grant an in-stream right at 200 second feet, assuming there will be plenty of water for everybody out there. What happens when somebody comes along and this decision is enforced? Somebody comes along and actually measures this stream and finds out it only has 100 second feet in it. Everybody will be shut down at that point based on a clear error by not going out and measuring each of these reaches. Think about either the liability to the individuals that may be shut down for a vast number of years, or the liability to the state if we could get a takings on this. And just as an example, I believe the project irrigators, which are below us, have filed for $1 billion for the 1 year in 2001 that they were shut off. We're primarily users above the lake, but think of the liability of people being shut off for 10 or 20 years based on an incorrect flow decision. And just think of the potential liability that may be out there. And I just want to hit home the point that if at all possible, we need every assistance in making this settlement go through so we don't have to go through this process, that we have something that we all can live with. And if it doesn't, I think that this committee and the legislature should do everything possible to make sure that those stream flow measurements are accurate and fair to the people and the producers out there.
Thank you, Edward.
Chair, could I go ahead and comment?
Please.
As Mr. Bartel has said, we indeed do have... before I say that, I would like to comment a little bit on his main point, too, that accuracy of measurements and on discharge of streams, how important it was. Had the opportunity to have existing department personnel who's here today, Mr. Reed Marbot, as well as Paul Curry, existing or the water resource director at the time, on property of mine several years ago, and I pointed out the error of what they were saying was in a particular stream. That particular stream, the upper spring ran 5 second feet. We have measurements since 1899 because it was a Bureau of Indian Affairs project at the time. There was an application that was for 70 second feet on that, and the department was showing the whole stream ran 70 second feet. If, in fact, those measurements have been used, those users on that upper 5 second feet would have been cut off. Upon pointing that out to Paul Curry, existing director, he said, well, Roger, he said, I guess what we have to say about this situation is that every decision and action made by a state agency should at least meet a straight face test. And I agreed with him, yes, indeed, it should meet a straight face test. To think that there was 70 second feet when there was only 5 just because you hadn't measured it wouldn't really meet a straight face test. But that lack of data have really hindered settlement of these various claims. And I was just in a participant in a telephone conference with people in Washington, D.C. and several people in Oregon trying to settle one of these. And there was complete frustration because the baseline data was not known. Was not known. How do we settle it without the baseline data? The job hadn't been done. I want to leave that alone for a minute. I am happy to say that we have, hopefully, the Upper Basin users and the Klamath Tribe and Bureau of Indian Affairs have reached an agreement and settlement of the adjudication, which is a bigger part of what is left to be heard in the adjudication. But here is the problem. The Bureau of Indian Affairs, Department of Interior, will no longer ratify an Indian water settlement without congressional action. They will not do it. They don't deny the ability of the state of Oregon through the various federal cases to adjudicate these waters, but they will not ratify a decision simply because they are afraid of litigation in later years, as explained to me. So therefore, we need congressional action to ratify this settlement, which we've done. Well, how do we get congressional action? Of course, we have to go back and work at it hard, and we have our congressional delegation. We were in Washington, D.C. not long ago, and everybody is on board. But it takes time, and it takes money to get that done. So how does that affect the state process? We have a legal brief due in July. As of yet, I have been completely refused to delay that legal brief. In other words, despite the fact of settlement out there that would end the need for that on most cases, not all. I mind there's a couple left, or there are several left that would still have to go forward if they don't settle out. But we still will be responsible probably for putting several hundred thousand dollars in this legal brief where we have a settlement and we're trying to get through Washington, D.C. and have promises that it probably will go through. And so therefore we have to go ahead, full scale ahead, spend more attorney money. The state of Oregon has to spend more money administering these cases because we're on some type of timetable that I guess God himself can't delay. I don't know. That's the impression I get. It really is. We're on a compacted, compressed schedule. The federal attorneys, the project attorneys, our attorneys, everybody has told the Water Resource Department that you can't even get this done in the timetable that you need to get it done and still offer due process anyway. So we have, I guess, a twofold request: delay the start of the process, and then if it's necessary, if everything doesn't settle out, give everybody due process, listen to the attorneys, and turn around and at least to be able to conduct the cases. Right now, that has not been granted as far as I know, and certainly our request to give us some time before we start the case has not been granted. It would seem that to me, it would seem everybody should be glad, celebrate that a settlement has been reached. I know that we've had so much positive press about this settlement, but we, once again, it's frankly, without us pursuing it from lobbying and so forth in Washington, D.C., it will get passed, but will it get passed in a timely manner? Probably not as timely as we'd like unless we actively pursue it. We do not have the money to go ahead and prepare legal briefs at the same time that we do settlements in Washington, D.C. I guess we just need some consideration and some reasonableness on part of the state of Oregon. After spending all the money, I think we have paid our dues and perhaps would deserve that consideration. And the active problems, I think I'll leave that alone. I do have some solutions. I don't know if anybody you would like to hear solutions after the fact, or anybody else to testify, or what would be your choice, Chair?
Let me start out if anyone has any questions, Chair. I'd be happy to listen to some solutions to see what you know, kind of positions you're trying to move, you know, forward, or think would help to move it forward. So, if you wanted to proceed with solutions, that would be great.
Thank you, Chair. Certainly one solution I've alluded to, though, on the settlement of us with the Indian case would be a continuance and active participation of the state try to get this done rather than pushing us in a corner that we can't meet. That is a solution, number one. Number two, that inventory of resources and usage of water needs to be completed, and it needs to be completed now. How much manpower, how much funding that would take, I don't know. We can certainly work with the state and show where their deficiencies are, and would be glad to, and have always been glad to. But that that inventory, assuming ours big case settles out, maybe some of that goes away. I don't know. It could go away. It was not, we purposely had a settlement based upon a subordination date for usages up to a certain time. There would be no call, no matter what the state granted the Federal Reserve rights. So therefore, because we didn't, and we did this because we didn't have any baseline information. We didn't have sufficient baseline information at all. We had to just pick a date and work around it. But certainly the inventory does need to be done, if not for us, for others. Long-term solutions? I think one wants to look at the Oregon adjudication statute and why are we duplicating upon duplication and seeing how much legal money we can spend. You might say, what difference does it make to Roger Nicholson or Edward Bartell or my friend Ambrose McAuliffe would like to testify today? We co-founded Water for Life. We spent years of our time helping the state producers, and I don't want anybody else to go through the process we've been through. It's been a nightmare. Quite frankly, in my opinion, seeing that it will be another trial basis at the circuit court, the statute needs to be amended such that the Water Resource Department is used as a source of information, develops all the information, gives it to the circuit court judge, start at the circuit court level, like there are some states that do. Start at the circuit court level. We've done a whole lot of false starts. Just recognize one administrative law judge we have, judge situation we have here in the state of Oregon, those recommendations are forwarded to the adjudicator. We go through all of that process, spend literally millions of dollars, and they're given to the adjudicator once, it's not to repeat myself, a political appointment. He makes the decision. He doesn't have to use any of that. Why did we do it? Because if it isn't satisfactory to one group, it's going to be called upon on the circuit court level, and it's going to be tried at circuit court level anyway. Use the Water Resource Department as a source of information and let it be a truly judicious process where everybody has their day in court to start with, rather than weeding everybody out that can't afford the process to start with. And who are those people? The only ones paying the attorney bills are us private producers. State of Oregon, individuals don't have to pay them. Maybe we all do. Federal government, we don't. And the whole theory that you run out of money, there's no justice. And we bear that every day, myself as a leader. But anyway, not to be preaching, that is the solution, I think, is to make it a truly judicious process, start at the circuit court level, eliminate the Water Resource Department level, except as the source of information. That's a long-term solution. The other long-term solution is, I think you better really turn around and look at the situation before you ever have another adjudication in the state of Oregon go through with the Federal Reserve Rights Incorporated. And why do I say that? Just because of all of the nightmares that we've experienced, and because you don't have to do that. You don't have to let those Federal Reserve Rights into it. Just what does it mean to everybody in the state? When Klamath gets done, it will be the only adjudicated area in the state of Oregon. Sure, you have lots of little piecemeal adjudications, but none with Federal Reserve Rights. If you allow the federal government there, you'll have 100-year-old ranches clear across the state of Oregon that have traded, that have sold, think they're secure. You'll adjudicate them, and those people will get left with nothing. I can assure you they'll get left with nothing. You'll turn around and be dedicating waters to in-stream, to marshes, to any number of reasons, and just because they had a previous adjudication is meaningless. It will be the only adjudicated area, Klamath will. That certainly needs to be looked at as a long-term solution. I would definitely, my advice, and I have, because of my contacts with Water for Life, I have people talk to me all over the state continuously. If, in fact, it comes to your neighborhood, don't spend the first dollar. Sell your ranch. Get out. Leave. You can't afford it. If you're a private producer, you cannot afford it under the present system. Leave. I think that my other long-term solution, though, if, in fact, we do continue, if we don't amend the statute and continue where we, the path we're headed upon, I very much think the state of Oregon ought to look at providing legal and technical assistance to its private producers. Don't leave them hanging there. I don't know of one group. It's only, I think, because of perhaps my Water for Life experience and the others that have been involved in the original organizational Water for Life that we even have non-profits representing the private people there. Unless Water for Life could afford it or some existing nonprofit, there would be no infrastructure. People in other parts of the state, individual producers, wouldn't even have the ability to protect themselves at all. That would be some of my solutions, and probably got a bit ahead of myself in the hearing because I think maybe Ambrose McAuliffe would like to testify, and maybe there are others on baseline problem or their experiences, but I'd certainly be honored to try to answer any questions.
Okay, anything else? Any questions? Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Jensen.
Appreciate your coming. I was in Klamath Falls a few days ago, and I can vouch for the fact to the members of the committee that you had quite a drive to get here, so we do want to recognize that and appreciate your taking that time and asking out of your schedule. So please, sir, if you would, go ahead.
Chair Jensen and respected members of this committee, I appreciate the opportunity to be here and share some thoughts. My name is Ambrose McAuliffe, that's MC, Irish origin, not Scottish. I was born and raised in Fort Klamath, Oregon. I more or less I'm almost a pure, you might say, Irishman on both sides. My father and my mother were both descendants of Irish origin. My grandfather, on my father's side, arrived in New York in 1910. He had $12 in his pocket and found his way to Lake County, Lakeview, Oregon, and proceeded to take up herding sheep for his uncle. So as years went by, one thing led to another, and our family ended up in Fort Klamath. At any rate, I was born in 1942, and I started a flood irrigation in my sophomore year in high school, 1958. A hired man on the 1st of July came down and announced that he was taking up another occupation and said, "Here's the shovel." And when you start to think about the time that's gone by, I was amazed to think that it's been 45 years and I'm still kind of doing the same thing. But in the course of this involvement brought on by the water issues and the adjudication, when Roger said to me one day, we need a statewide organization or we're going to lose it all. We even had a magazine of our own for a while. It was called the Water Digest. We went to great lengths to trying to hold the line and put up a proactive approach to dealing with all these issues. Instead of 15 years, I was adding up the time. It's actually 16 years that we've been toe-to-toe, head-to-head with these issues, trying to resolve things in a minimal manner to everybody concerned. We had all kinds of experiences, but early on we got involved with fish screening, and that was probably our lead into our proactive stances. We've got, I might say, one of the claims to fame that is significant in my mind in our area. I think it goes probably statewide. We have a solar powered fish screen larger than anywhere you might imagine, and it was built right there in Fort Klamath, Oregon, by an irrigator. So over the course of time, we obviously went with the fencing of the riparian areas. We had fish ladders, and we were responsible for this permanent program in place today that's still functioning and effective, the permanent fish screening program that has cost share benefits there on both sides, the public, the private, as well as the state. So it is a workable thing, and we found that by coming to this Salem and to the folks at that particular time, much like we are today, could bear some fruit. They did hear and they did respond. We proved the odds makers wrong. We showed that we could make a difference. But on another note, I want to say I was out in the field yesterday looking across the pasture at this heifer that had lost her calf to a coyote the night before. And I drove over there and buried the calf so the rest of the predators, the birds and the buzzards and so forth, wouldn't attract more coyotes. And what touched me about this was this little heifer who had turned her back momentarily and then came back to find that her calf was a meal for the coyote, and she was so distraught over this, as you might imagine any mother should be. The way she bawled and cooed and walked back and forth and sniffed and carried on, it gave me a real empty feeling in my stomach. And I might say I felt some real emotion. I thought, now, if I could just carry that to the folks up here as to how all this business with this adjudication and the struggles we've been going through, trying to keep this thing alive and keep our foot in the door and be a player, if I could just get that message across, you might live in hope, God willing, help make a difference and change the course of the direction this is going. On a personal note, my own personal life has taken a change. Having been married for 42 years, my wife, because of all the emotional distress and the financial issues all told revolving around these water issues that have been going on, she has taken up herding sheep in Saskatchewan, Canada. She comes home every month or so, but she's had to get away. It was a question of matter or being committed, I guess you might say. And I encouraged her to do that because she was becoming hard to live with, you might put it mildly. And then I thought, after she took me up on this, that I don't know if I like this or not, and I told her she had to come home or I was going to divorce her. Well, she believed me for a little while, and then, of course, I had to change my mind, because it's kind of hard to imagine after that long that you're going to divorce your partner. Whatever the case. But the thing that I need to make a point of is we did sell a home and the ranch to get even with the bank and pay off some things that have a lot to do with the subjects we're talking about here today, to get square with the world. I still have an interest, a very active interest, because we kept some acreage that still has the same issues to deal with. And having been a co-founder and a cohort, I would be remiss not to stay in the game and try to encourage my fellows all I can and provide what support I can and pay my way. But if you can imagine the empty feeling, and it wasn't just feeling sorry for this heifer that was the object of the predator, but in my subconscious I know the same feeling was going through my emotional system, that, you know, we're the prey and the predator is, they are everywhere and they're after us, and, you know, is what's the brighter side to all this? We're still living in hope. We're like the pizza, you know, we never know. As long as there's life, and you will hear whatever stories we might bring to you, we might make a difference. And I just want to thank you for the time.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your coming, appreciate your testimony. I might say that your wife's situation, you and your wife's situation, kind of reminds me something of sometimes my own personal situation, as I am forced to deal with some of the issues that I have to deal with here. I become pretty hard to live with, too. And I'm only grateful that my wife, who used to be superintendent of a mental health or of a mental hospital, is no longer has that job, because I think she would commit me at times. So thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, members.
Mr. Chair, if I may I just wrap up quickly and briefly?
Please.
Thank you. Chair Jensen and members of the committee, again, I really want to thank you for this opportunity, for allowing us to come forward and to have some producers come before you and tell you what they're really feeling and how this is really affecting them. And I guess at this point, if I were sitting where you are sitting, I'd be asking, well, what do we do? I mean, we've heard about all of the problems, and we've heard some possible solutions, but how can we be a part of this process and hopefully influencing it for the better in the future? And as you've heard, we're expecting that adjudications will continue to happen in this state, mostly on the west coast of the Cascades, and that they're getting pretty darn complicated. So to that note, or on that note, I should say, I just want to kind of wrap up some of the things you've heard here today. I think the biggest point is we would say we need some kind of cooperation from the Water Resources Department on two points. One, to be allowing settlements to proceed. As Mr. Nicholson said, they do have a settlement that is going forward with the Bureau of Indian Affairs, but because their calendar is so crunched, they're not going to be able to pursue both settlements and their legal obligations. So some leniency on exactly what is scheduled when would be nice. We'd also like to see the baseline information really put together well, and to be in a useful format to really do the adjudication right. So to finish measuring those streams and to have real-time data of what is actually in the stream, to be able to make those adjudications from there and not just on a computer estimate or guess, even if it is an educated one. Basically, also, please just continue to oversee this process and be aware of it. And again, thank you for giving us the opportunity to kind of speak to that and maybe raise your awareness a little bit of that, of what's going on the ground. As our legislators, you have a lot of sway, and you can say a lot to the powers that be about that, and to start asking questions and to really be informed just about the adjudication and ways also to improve the statute. As you've heard, it's a very administratively top-heavy process. You spend a lot of money in the administrative portion of the process before you even get to the circuit court, which is where the final regulation should occur anyway. So on that note, I would again just thank you for the opportunity to be here today, for the invited panel. I know we all really appreciate your time. And I'd be happy to answer any questions if you do have any.
Okay. Any questions? No. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time, your effort. And I certainly cannot fully understand. I can understand, you know, with my mind, the issues, the problems. But unlike yourself, sir, I can't really understand it. You know, down here it is somewhat of an abstraction. Until, of course, the problems that you faced in the Klamath Basin come to my community, and then I'll be able to understand it. Hopefully that won't happen, but that would have been your hope 20 years ago, too. So it goes back, I guess, to our adage that we had when we started this water committee of this session, that whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting. And we certainly seem to be complicating our life with the fighting at this point in our history. So thank you again for
Thank you.
Mr. Kosasan, are you trying to signal me about something?
No, sir.
We did make some mention of the times that I become hard to live with, and some of the groups who are here are certainly a part of that when they get involved in the internal fightings, I would think of that. I think there may be some others. I'm going to want to hear from the department a little bit on an explanation, a rejoinder, if you wish, of what we've had. And I think, Mr. Myers, I'm not sure if you'd like to do that today or if you'd like to wait and prepare a little more, you know, with this. I'm going to say we only have about 20 minutes left that I can allow left in this for any other testimony, so I'm willing to come back at a later time and continue the informational meeting on that. And I see the Water Resource Department is comfortable with that. Doug, where are you at? Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Doug Myers, and I'm here today representing Water Watch, Trout Unlimited, which is a nationwide organization devoted to cold water fishing. And also the Klamath Tribes are a client of mine. And I'll just be very brief and say I listened very closely to the testimony. I keep saying my tribes. I get very possessive. The Klamath Tribes have reached settlement with the irrigators, and that wasn't easy on either side. And Water Watch continues to be an active participant in the adjudication. Trout Unlimited is mainly concerned with the Klamath River below the dams, which are in California, and how the fish that go out to sea and come back, their passage and so forth. But if you want any of my clients to be here, I will certainly ask them at a future date. But I do think we'd be happy to.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that, and I would leave you with the point that if any of your clients would like to, and you can reflect to them what has transpired here so far, but if any of them would like to come to let you know, and we will so arrange somewhere the schedule to accommodate that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Okay. With that, then, we will close this informational hearing on Klamath Basin adjudication policy, process and policy, and we will open our work session on House Bill 2265, and I think we have Legislative Council, Brendan McCarthy, and Mr. Lilly from the Department of State Lands. After that. Gentlemen, if I can refer or summarize kind of what's taken place on what we have now as a -3 amendment to House Bill 2265. This is a -3 amendment that we're currently looking at, and initially this started out, I believe it was House Bill 2130, is that correct? And we have taken basically the contents of that House bill and are moving it into this particular vehicle via the proverbial gut and stuff process. We had the confusion over this in the last session. We had a dash 2 amendment and then a dash 3 amendment, and we had the original 2130. And I would like to have you, if you would, kind of walk through the dash 3 amendment and explain to the members of the committee what distinguishes the dash 3 amendment from the original bill, and then what is the distinction between the dash 3 amendments and the dash 2 amendments, which was what we were trying to work with, what we thought we were working with last time.
Mr. Chair, may I ask a question before we proceed? So this, and this little paper that we just got today, when it says effective committee amendment, that was the dash 2 amendment, or does this refer to the dash 3 amendment?
I'm not sure.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it was the dash 2 amendment.
So we can cross that out.
Right.
Right? And we
Correct.
Can cross out the background, right?
Well, the background is the background from the original bill. The background won't change until we actually adopt an amendment so that that background reflects what the amendment. This was the background on the SMS that you have in front of you is basically the background on the original 2130.
But it has nothing to do with the dash 3 amendment. Is that correct? So
well, it does, but only in the original 2130 sense, not necessarily what the amendment is doing. Because we haven't reviewed the amendments?
Yeah.
The background does not include any of the changes on the amendment. It is the original 2130.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. And that's what we're starting out reviewing
right.
is
right.
the difference between the dash 3 and 2130. Is that
okay.
correct? Okay. All right.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. Brendan McCarthy from Legislative Council. As you correctly stated, this had its start as House Bill 2130. The major differences between 2130 and this gotten stuff of 2265, at least policy-wise, can be seen in changes that were made in Section 2. And some changes in Sections 17 and 18, which would be to ORS 196.825.
Can you give us a page number?
That would be page, Section 17 would start on page 27 of the dash 3 amendments. Between the dash 2s and the dash 3s, however, I think I mentioned on in previous testimony on Monday that there was a small hang-up. I'm not exactly sure how it was, where it was from, pulling in some language that from another bill, from Senate Bill 170, that contained a deletion of subsection 11 of 196.825. When that got placed into Section 17 and 18 of this bill, that was a inadvertent omission. So this dash 3 amendment adds that language back in for subsection 11. So you'll note that's no longer bracketed.
That's Section 11.
Subsection 11 of 196.825, which appears in Section 17 and 18 of the bill, and would be on starting on page 31 of for Section 17. And starting on page 36 for Section 18. And Section 17 and 18 are double amends, so they stay primarily, they're mostly the same.
Brendan, I have Section 17, ORS 196.825, is amended to read on page 27.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and then, as I said, the differences between the dash 2 and the dash 3 amendments would appear starting on page 31, where subsection 11 of 196.825 is no longer bracketed.
Starting on page 31. Okay. That subsection 11 is no longer. This is the difference between the dash 2s and the dash 3s?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
I did make one small change on page 32. I left bracketed a subsection reference, subsections 1 to 5 of this section.
Right.
Which I think is no one should have much of a problem with and makes life easier for me and our office if we can get rid of subsection references. There were no policies and standards set forth in any of the other subsections of that section, so I assumed the change would be okay.
I do have a question of why that was bracketed in my notes on this.
Well, as I said, Mr. Chair, I think that there aren't any policies and standards set forth in subsection 6 to 11, and given that that was a non-substantive change and makes future amendments easier to make without having to worry about altering subsection references, I went ahead and deleted that language.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. Mr. Lilly.
Chair, members of the committee, John Lilly, Assistant Director with the Department of State Lands. I'm prepared to walk you through a bit on these the changes that are put forward in the dash 3s. I can do it section by section or attempt to summarize what I think are the most important points.
We will start out with the summary, and we'll go back after you've summarized it, go through section by section.
Very good. Just as an overview, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, this bill originally, as we've said, the substance of this bill was embodied in House Bill 2130. It was basically a fee bill to increase the removal fill permit fees. The fees have not been changed since 1987, and we bring forward this proposal to increase those individual permit fees, as well as to ask for an implementation of new fees for three new areas. One is to allow for a fee for emergency authorizations at the same rate as the individual permits. Second, to allow the department by rule to establish a fee for general authorizations, which make up about 60 to 70% of the types of authorizations that we issue. Those would be the fees for each general authorization would be established by administrative rule based upon the amount of work necessary to process the application and the issue the authorization. And then thirdly, a fee which would allow us to charge for the review and the concurrence with wetland delineation reports that are tendered with the department as part of a permit application or come to us well in advance of a permit application or because an applicant is interested in knowing what the limits of the wetland might be on their property in order to do future planning or to sell the property. That fee of $325 would be a new fee for us. It would fund an additional position, which would enable us to give better service to people submitting those reports to us. We've had a 250% increase in those reports over the last 10 years without any additional staffing to do that work. And you had testimony, I believe, last month from members of the consultant community and others that indicated their interest in being able to have this work done in a more timely manner. So to the bill, to the amendment. Section 2, it deals with this issue of the wetland delineation report fees. It defines the terms that we commonly use to identify these kinds of reports. It says, refers to the standard in which we use to establish when a report meets the required qualifications. The This section also allows for the imposition of a expedited process should someone want to get their report reviewed more quickly than under our normal process. They could do so for an additional fee, which we would establish by rule, and through a process that we would establish by rule.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dinkelman.
Thank you. John, typically, what is the time frame for review of a wetland delineation? Do you have a maximum time that you try to turn that around?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, yes, we do. We have, as a result
or
of this...
You should say minimum, I'm sorry. Well, it would be a maximum, but what's your average, I guess?
As it turns out, it's both. As a result of the increase in workload, we finally had to say we just can't do all of these that come at us. And so we established a prioritization process, and we said, all right, those reports that come to us in association with a permit application, we're required by statute to turn those around for the permit decision within 90 days after a complete application. So that's our top priority, is those reports that come in with an application, 90 days. So, and if you let me refer to another report I have here. Yeah, Dana, thanks. I knew I wouldn't be able to find it when I wanted it. I was glad Dana brought him along. The tier two reports that we call them are those that don't fall into these applications. They're not for a proposed mitigation bank. They're not associated with an industrial property that's trying to be certified, and it's not a part of a pre-application process. So everything else, we don't have a timeline. So what happens is that we get to them as soon as we can based upon, what the workload is. And oftentimes those can stretch out for months before we even look at them for the first time. There are other applications or reports that we've just told people, don't send these to us, or if you do, don't expect us to review them at all because of the crush of this other higher priority work. And those, for example, that we're unlikely to review are those associated with a property that's for sale that people want to know, if they have wetlands there and what the extent of them are. Habitat restoration projects, we do those when we're able to. We work those in. And then another category is bridge projects where the wetlands happen to be within the ordinary high water. We may review those. But basically, we've had to say to some folks, look, we just don't have the resources to address your reports at this time. And we're hoping that with the imposition of this fee and the additional staff we'll be able to acquire or fund with the fee, that we would be able to do better in terms of turnaround and also being able to review more of the reports that come before us. Because at the very baseline, we would like to be able to review and provide the service to every report that comes to us. We think it's a public service. It's worthwhile. It's good for folks to know. If they want to know whether they have a jurisdictional wetland on their property, it's good for them to know that so that they can avoid it when they're doing their development, or they can take that into account as they're doing a property transaction. It disappoints us that we're not able to provide the service in as timely a way or as efficiently as we could if we had just a little bit more staff and a little bit more help through this fee.
Thank you, John. Just a follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
So, John, the the receipts authority, are you proposing that would apply to the Tier 2, or it's not applications, but I guess the Tier 2 wetland delineations?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, I think that would be our attempt. We'd pick up the Tier 2 work first, and then we'd work down the list. My opinion is that because there's a backlog on this work, and because many folks really covet the state's review of their reports because the federal government doesn't do this work, is that I think we're going to see a kind of a crush of work initially, probably through this next biennium. After that, I think we'll see a little bit of a slowdown. It'll be more manageable. We have some concerns that even with this, expedited process and kind of the receipts authority kind of thing, that even at that, we may be hard-pressed to meet our own expectations. But we're going to try, and if we have continued difficulty, we will be back in front of the the 2007 session to give report on what we've been able to do.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Brummel.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, but I think Representative Barnhart had his hand up earlier than I did, and so I'll yield to him, and then if you'll come back to me.
Missed you, Representative. Please, go ahead.
It's on this topic, if I may. Right. Can you tell us what timely manner means in line 6 of page 2?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, currently timely manner is what we say for Tier 1 projects. It's within 120 days of receiving that. I am concerned that timeliness from our point of view may not be timeliness for someone else, obviously. We're going to have to flesh that out during our rulemaking on this area. It'll be... I don't think that we can allow these reports to be sitting around for months and months and months on end without some response from the agency. And I think giving us this opportunity and additional staffing will put us in a better position to be able to respond in anybody's timely manner. At this point, we're turning folks away and telling them we can't provide the service that we would like to provide. I don't have an exact number, sir, at this point for beyond what we call Tier 2 right now.
So if somebody needs something in less than 4 months under this plan, they would want to ask for an expedited review and pay an additional fee.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, that's correct. That's what my expectation would be.
Now I'm putting together your conversation with Representative Dingfelder with what's actually in the bill, and I appreciate that.
Thank you, Representative. I think that's an important point in the record would show that the department has indicated 120 days as a timely manner. We won't put that in statute, but...
we'll remember.
But it will show on the record that that's what it is.
Yes.
I've got a question by Representative Crummell, but Brendan wants to speak, I think, to this issue, if that's all right, Representative.
That'd be fine, sure.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee... that type of term would generally be considered a delegable term, and that would be up to the department to make a determination as to what timely manner was. So,
but it was the understanding of this committee that's 120 days at the present time.
I understand that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, Representative Crummell, you have a question.
Well, I guess, and I have a couple of questions on this, Mr. Chair, but sort of the first one that now is, since we've talked about expedited, is expedited mean anything under 120 days? So if somebody show up with, in 119 days and it was an expedited review? I mean, I realize it's kind of a facetious question, but it's really not.
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, I don't understand the question.
Well, because if I may, Mr. Chair, clarify this, you can get an expedited review if you pay an additional fee. So you're going to pay a fee for a review that should occur within 120 days. So if we're going to have an expedited review, then, and I pay an additional fee, so how expedited is expedited? I mean, because if it comes in at 119 days, well, it was expedited by a day, and if I paid an additional fee, quite frankly, I'm going to be pretty ticked. If I pay an additional fee, my expectation as a customer would be, if I'm paying a fee for a review, and then I have the option of paying an additional fee for an expedited review, and I need an expedited review, I'm anticipating that an expedited review is 15 to 30 days. Yeah. Now, if it's longer than that, then I'm going to be real concerned about the amount of fee that I'm paying.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, I think that there are two factors to be involved here. One is, of course, the duration of time in which it takes us to review the report. The second is, what is the purpose of the report? And right now, we're dividing the workload up into the purpose for which the report is given to us. So if you've got a report that's associated with a removal fill permit, we're going to work that report through within the 120 days that's required by law after the completed application. Okay, if you tender a report with us that's not for that purpose, it's for because you're planning a development on your property and you want to be able to give your civil engineer an accurate description of where the wetland is on that property so that your architect and civil engineer can avoid impacts to the wetland and therefore avoid a permit, that's not something that's going to make it into our top tier, top priority project, top priority to review. And so as a result, you may say, I want an expedited review on that. And that's what that process is designed to do, is to deal with those folks who are going to fall outside what we call a tier one, who may otherwise just get worked in to the queue as the staff has time, and it may take them several months to get there.
So then, Mr. Chair, that kind of brings me back around to my original question as to why I raised my hand, and I in no way mean to turn this into an audits committee, but I do have a question because of something that Mr. Lilly said earlier in his testimony, and that was that you require these reports to be done, and so I'm assuming that we require them in statute or they're required by law, but that you may or may not ever get to them. Now, I have a little problem with if a person is paying a fee to have a report looked at, it damn well ought to be looked at. But the other side to it is that if we may or may not ever get to it because of, and I don't care, you know, any, as far as the customer is concerned, any excuse will do. So it doesn't matter. I mean, I don't, see, as a customer, I don't care if you're understaffed. That's not my problem.
Right.
My problem is I've got a report that I have to turn in, and I have to pay a fee to have it reviewed, and then you're telling me it may or may not ever get reviewed. Then why in the hell is it even required? Why don't we eliminate the requirement for that report?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, I think you've misunderstood my statement. I did not say that a report is required in every instance. And it isn't. It happens to be in some of those instances where, and I did say that we've been telling folks in some cases, we can't get to your report. Okay. It's not a requirement that those reports be reviewed and approved by the department. In many cases, the applicant or the individual, the property owner, desires to have the report reviewed and approved by the department because it gives them assurance and certainty as to the location of the jurisdictional wetlands and waters on their property. It is their choice. Those that we require, when we require a delineation report, is an instance where it's associated with an application for a permit to do removal of fill in waters of the state. That is a requirement. And those, we are giving we're making those decisions and jurisdiction within the statutory required time of the 120 days. Sometimes more quickly, but that is our outside limit. So to make my point again, there is no requirement that a property owner submit a jurisdictional wetland determination report to us in every instance. In the cases when they do desire to know if there's wetland on their property, they can do so. And in the past, we have expeditiously and worked hard to review all those reports and get them back out to folks, no matter what their purpose and desire was. But simply because of the crush of the workload, we've had to prioritize where we spend our time. And we've chosen to spend our time on those reports that are required to come to us in order to issue the permit.
So, if I may, Mr. Chair, I just want to clarify what you said, John. It's a matter of, if I'm a property owner and I'm looking at some kind of a development that I want to do, and I want to go ahead and bet on the come, I don't have to do a delineation report, and somebody could show up at a later time, Thousand Friends of Oregon or Sierra Club or some other group that felt like they wanted to could show up, and even if my project were started, they could show up on the day that we have the heaviest rainfall of the year and say, you have a wetland over there, and force my project to be stopped until I can prove that it is in fact not a wetland, unless I've got this report from your office that says that's not a wetland. Yeah, you get a little standing water when it rains real hard, but otherwise it's not considered a wetland. And Am I correct in that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, that is a situation that can occur. Yes. So what the property owner sometimes is looking for is that assurance ahead of doing his project, that he knows where the jurisdictional wetland is, and he either has acquired the permit, or he or she has done their work in such a way that they can avoid the jurisdictional waters and therefore avoid the need for a permit. It is a risk analysis, an assessment that property owner, that developer does as a part of their development process. Now, there are times when local government, and this is a circumstance that we've encountered from time to time, where local government has required that a report be submitted to the department and that the department sign off on that. Those two we try to work in the process. It's put us in a very uncomfortable situation where we're trying to give the highest priority attention to those projects associated with the permit, and yet there's someone who knows they're not going to be developing in the wetland, but they need the state of Oregon's sign off in order to satisfy the local government. We try to work with local government and the property owner to work through those. I've mediated a number of conversations with property owners and local government over those issues, and tried to serve the interests of both the local government and the property owner. It's one of those things where, you know, one group won't move without the others, okay? And, you know, we work those in and try to expedite those as best we can, given the other workload that we have.
Mr. Chair?
Mayor?
Thank you for that explanation. Then, I'm trying to remember, it seems to me that you had testified to this before, and it was maybe another bill, or maybe it wasn't you and it was somebody else in a different committee. I don't know. But do you use, and so let me clarify, John, do you use contractors, for example, when your workload just gets really high, do you bring in contractors to try to get that back under control? Because I'm sure seasonally there are more requests and, you know, because of the building season and that sort of thing. So when you get those big backlogs, do you tend to use contractors that come in and help you get those run through and assessed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, thank you for asking that question. Yes, it wasn't me. I think it might have been someone else, but it was a great question. Yes, we have. This last biennium, or this current biennium, we've, on two different occasions, we've hired consultants to help us to do this work, as in the same fashion that you'd hire a review appraiser to a review an appraisal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been helpful. But what we find is that it is not a complete time savings, in that we still have to administer the contract, we still have to get the reports to the consultant, manage the consultant's work, get the report back. Staff tells me that there's about a 75% savings in time, if you gather what I'm saying. You still have to invest staff time to get the work done. So it is very helpful. It's like having another, some more help on. We have done that, like I say, on two different occasions. We have one contract still working, and that has helped us quite a bit. But even at that, we still feel like we need additional assistance to do that work. That's was a $35,000 expenditure, and for service that we're not receiving any repayment for.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you said this, and I'm just circling back around. This is a new fee for approval of report and jurisdictional determination. Okay.
Yes, sir.
And the result of that is that you expect to be able to add capacity.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, that's exactly
that was
correct.
The point of this, wasn't it?
That's correct.
Thank
sir.
You. Yeah.
You recall that the. I'm sorry.
That leads me to a question that I have in relationship to Section 2 and the fees. Because it says in Section 2, sub 8, fees received by the department under this section shall be credited to the common school fund for use by the department in administering ORF. And I assume that means that 196 under 2905 is the issue that Representative Barnhart is referring to, administration of this, which then leads me to the concern, I guess, that I have in relationship to a second $325 fee for a rejected report may be revised by the person that submitted that report to meet the requirements established by rule and may be resubmitted to the department. And again, the fee is $325. That might seem to be a fairly heavy fee for the report fix, which might take you, you know, a matter of 10 minutes looking at what the fix was and signing off on it. And so I have a little bit of concern that, yeah, I mean, if they have to redo the entire report and you have to do your, you know, the whole analysis from scratch, in essence, then I understand the, you know, that. But I would expect that there will be a number of reports that you would reject, that it might take just minor fixes to bring them into compliance. Could you speak to that and give me...
Certainly, Mr. Chair. The issue here is the fee for a resubmittal of a rejected report. You know, it isn't not our intention to just reject reports for minor
cash flow thing. You got need for
cash certainly
flow.
The common school fund and issue is one that's on the front of our mind, but service and fair service is also right there as well. It's not our intention to make this permit or this fee into a money mill or this process into a money mill for the common school fund, but rather if we have small technical problems with the report, we'll certainly allow for those to be corrected as we do now, and the report to be resubmitted without additional fee. It is, however, amazing as to the number of reports that we review that are problematic and require basically a rework. And were I to line up staff here, they would regale you with many stories of long hours spent almost to the point of doing the work for the applicant. And I think it's appropriate in these cases when, in large part, we're getting a very new report back in.
Mr. Chair, can I just make a quick follow-up question to that point, to your point?
All right.
Which is, how often does that entail a field visit by the staff? I mean, is that more common than not where there would entail a field visit in addition to reviewing the report in...
For the record, your name, please. Have a chair.
For the record, my name is Dana Field. I'm former wetland delineation staff and now the wetland mitigation bank person.
And you have come along as Mr. Lilly's brains for the day.
Back up. Sure. Our estimate is that we have time to make a site inspection or need, because the report has conflicting information within it, that we need to make a site visit on about 15% of the reports that are submitted. I think it was also our intention on this expedited fee, because they are after certainty, that to deliver that certainty, that we would expect to make a site visit for those.
Okay. Thank you very much. And members, I'm going to have to close the work session for today because of time commitments that I have, and I'm sure that you have too. So with that, we will close the work session on 2265 for today, and I'll reopen the work session on 2265, having said that. And I would like to have a motion to move the Dash 3 amendments into House Bill 2265.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash three amendments into be adopted or into House Bill 2265.
Representative Dingfelder has moved that we adopt the dash three amendments into House Bill 2265. Is there any questions or objections?
I won't object, Mr. Chair, but I do have some concerns about the dash threes.
That's fine, Representative. I just want to have something that we're working with, so that we all know who's on second, sort of thing. With that, then I'll so order that they will be adopted into House Bill 2265, and with that, we will move this over to Monday, May 2. And, colleagues, I would remind members of the committee that we have next week to move House bills out into the real world of the floor, or the Ways and Means Department, as the case may be. So we'll be cleaning up the calendar next week as far as House bills are concerned.
Okay.
And there will be no meeting on Friday. The field trip to the Big Dig, or the Big Pipe, as the case may be, is postponed, and not indefinitely, but we don't have an exact date. Actually, it'll certainly be after next week, because we'll probably have a little bit of extra work to get done next week to make sure we get our calendar cleared as we would have. Yes, Representative Barnhart.
You're saying I'm going to be able to work on other things Friday afternoon?
I'm saying that Friday afternoon you can take off.
That was not my question, Mr. Chair.
I would never suppose that the fact that we're not meeting here would mean that you're going to work on something else. I wouldn't want to take away from your R&R time that you may be in need of at that point.
Well, I think I better stop at that stage and let you adjourn.
Okay. With this, we are adjourned for today.